So it's great that everybody's so enthusiastic about black holes as I am. So yuppie, yuppie. all right. So I would like to discuss today black holes. But we shall see that actually we can learn about black holes by studying much, much simpler space-time, which is that of the Rindler space-time, which we have already seen in your homework one and, you know, in some previous lectures. And so basically, what is a mystery about black holes can be already understood there. And so I will try to go that way. But before we go there, let me just have a historical remark that actually something like black holes was already studied long time ago. And so there was a notion of dark stars due to Mitchell, and it was already in the 18th century. And so the idea was very simple, is that you have a star of radius R and mass M, and then you may be studying the escape velocity from this star. So you just shoot a particle or you shoot something outside here, and either it comes back or it doesn't, right? So if it comes back, then you haven't shoot fast enough. But if it actually escapes all the way to infinity, then you shoot with the velocity which exceeds the escape velocity, and then so now the question is, you know, is there such a beast, such a star, for which actually even the light cannot escape? So of course this was deep in Newtonian times. So what Mitchell assumed is of course completely wrong, but he thought, you know, light is just a ball of some mass m, which propagates at the speed of light. Okay, so then the simple calculation is simply that you have a kinetic energy of the light is something like that, 1/2 mc². Okay, so light. And then, of course, the gravitational pull here on that, the potential is minus g m m over r. Okay, and so if this is just to escape to infinity, then of course at infinity I'm pretending the light has no longer any velocity, so it's just zero, and of course this is also zero, so the whole thing is zero, and this is for the escape velocity is v equal to c. Okay, so now funny thing is that you can solve this equation for, you know, the radius of the star. And so if you solve this equation for the radius of star, you find that the corresponding radius of the star is precisely 2gm over c square. Okay, so that's what you find by doing this very, very naive Newtonian physics. But surprisingly, if you just plug in back the units to the Schwarzschild metric, this is precisely the radius of the black hole as we know it today. So this coincides with radius of Schwarzschild black hole. So here you are doing something super crazy. You are pushing Newtonian physics beyond its limits. You are treating light or whatever. You are shooting particles which have some mass with the velocity of light, and then but then you find actually that this actually is exactly the same as the full prediction of general relativity. All right, so of course the interpretation is completely different. That's obvious from the derivation. And moreover, such dark stars are actually not completely dark. They're just dark for the outside observer, from very, very distant observer. However, the information from these stars actually can leak out. And so you just place several observers along the path. And so maybe you cannot reach with the light from here to that observer, but you can still reach it here. Right, and so then this observer knows that the light was sent, and so he can send another light to this observer and to that observer and to that observer, and finally the whole information can actually leak out. All right, of course that's not the case with the black hole. So with the black hole, there is basically this region characterized by r equal to r plus, and so nothing can escape from there. So even if you have an observer just standing slightly above the horizon, that observer will not see anything coming from the black hole. All right, so this is just a historical remark. So now, of course, the statement is that true black holes are described by general relativity SIGR, and let us study the simplest one. So for example, the Schwarzschild black hole, for example, Schwarzschild. And so what it means is that we take the Schwarzschild metric, which let me just write it again. So DS, the most important metric, apart from flat metric and FRW spacetime, is minus F dt square plus dr square over F plus r square d omega square, where the omega square is just sine square theta d phi square plus d theta square. And the metric function f is just 1 minus 2m over r, where m is an integration constant. And we know that it corresponds to basically a pool, gravitational pool of an object of mass m. At least that's what an observer at infinity would say. All right, so that's our solution. But of course, so yesterday we interpreted the solution as the solution for field outside of stars and planets and so on. So as long as you are in vacuum and you are spherically symmetric, this is the right solution. But then I told you maybe we can actually, and of course in that case, you have to replace this solution with some interior solution which describes your star. So you have to describe the star inside, and then outside you have the Schwarzschild metric. However, then I told you maybe the other interpretation is that we understand this solution all the way to r equal to zero. So we take this all the way to r equal to zero. And so we know that at r equal to zero already, we know that already that at r equal to zero there is a singularity. Because there is, we could construct a scalar, which was this Kretschmann scalar, r mu nu kappa lambda square, and that actually blew up at r equal to zero. And so that means there is a curvature singularity that's true in any coordinate system. And so we cannot continue there. So r equal to zero has to be removed from the manifold. So this is a true singularity at r equal to zero. At r equal to zero, because we know that some scalar actually diverges there. So now my favorite question is, well, we observe this for the Riemann tensor square, that blows up. So then my favorite question is, can you construct any other scalar which should blow up there at r equal to zero? So you can start thinking about that. All right. But of course, we also notice that there is another problem at r equal to 2m, which was the r plus. So in order to really interpret this solution as physical solution, okay, we can live with the fact that r equal to zero is problematic, but we want to interpret all the way to r equal to zero. So in particular, we want to make sense what's happening at r equal to r plus, which is 2m. So another problem is at r equal to r plus equals to 2m. And so we really need to understand what's happening there in order, to take this solution for granted. And so the answer will be interesting. So from one point of view, nothing really strange is happening at r equal to 2m. And then from another point of view, everything strange is happening from at r equal to 2m. Okay, so there will be some, weird things here. So weird things happen here. Okay, and so to actually demystify this, what's happening at r equal to 2m, let me just do something much, much simpler. Let me just study again the Windler space as we did, the third lecture or second lecture. All right, so to understand this, we shall study the Windler space. Let's look at Windler again. And as we shall see, this will actually completely demystify black holes. So you will see that actually there's nothing mysterious about black holes at all. So everything can already be understood here. All right, so how does the Rindler space look like? So I was always doing just two-dimensional space. There can be other two directions, y and z, which are not interesting. So let's just write two-dimensional metric. So ds squared was minus 1 plus ax squared d squared. This is a capital X. Well, don't write it that way. It's capital X. And then dx squared. And so, of course, this was the metric which an observer who is uniformly accelerating in Minkowski space would actually associate with herself. Okay, so if the observer will be sitting at x equal to 0, and t would be the proper time of that observer, and so we have these nice coordinates here. So now, what I mentioned and what we already know, how this actually looks like, we know that the coordinate t simply goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. On the other hand, the coordinate x is actually bounded. So this thing becomes 0 when x is minus 1 over a. And so we have to decide which part of the thing we are considering. So let me concentrate on the case when x is bigger than x plus, which is this minus 1 over a. Okay, so we have this x plus here. And let's consider the range of the coordinates where x actually ranges from minus 1 over a to plus infinity. Okay, and so then this thing is actually well defined and the metric makes sense. But you know, if you look at this thing here, you know, of course what's happening at x equal to x plus is that we sort of see a singularity similar to the singularity at r equal to r plus, right? So you know, the question which we are trying to answer is, you know, and we know that this is precisely the Rindler horizon, right? So this x equal to x plus describes the Rindler horizon. And the question is it really a singular thing or not? So I just remind you the picture. So the picture was we had the Rindler horizon. So this was precisely x equal to x plus, x equal to x plus. And then we had constant lines of x look like that. So let's say this is our observer at x equal to 0. And then we had also the lines of constant capital T. And they were simply straight lines. So this was capital T equals to 0. And then let's say this is T equal to 10. And then this is T equal to 100 and so on. So now we have this Rindler horizon here, which is at x equal to x plus. And that, of course, corresponds to also t equal to infinity. So if I want to make the line like that, all the way like that, then that would correspond to t equal to infinity. So the question is, you know, is x equal to x plus singular, and what happens here? Okay, so that's what we are trying to understand. And if you can understand it here, maybe that will tell us what's happening with the black hole at r equal to r plus. All right, so the first thing you can do is then you can say, well, let's consider an observer who is at fixed position x. So consider Alice and Bob, and they both of them actually hovering at this above this horizon at fixed position x. So let's say one of them is at x equal to 0, and the other one is at different x. And so then let's say that these observers actually send signals one to another. And let's calculate the corresponding redshift of the signal. Okay, so we have done this calculation many times. So we have Bob and Alice, Bob and Alice, and then they are static observers at different values of x at different eggs. And so let's calculate what is the corresponding ratio of the frequencies they actually see. So we have omega A divided by, so frequency measured by Alice divided by frequency measured by Bob. And so we know that this is from long time ago. This is just the ratio of the proper times. But now, oh, delta, whatever, tau A. Okay, so that's the inverse ratio of the proper times. And then we just use this metric here. So we are sending x equal to 0. And so what really matters is this GTT component, but now with capital T, right? So this is just square root of minus GTT evaluated at B divided by square root of minus GTT evaluated at A. And if you look at what this is, it's just 1 plus A XB, 1 plus A XA. All right, so that's the ratio of frequencies, or you know, how fast the time is going for Bob and how fast it is going for Alice. And so then, let's say that we send Bob all the way to the horizon, okay? So then, so now assume, so let's send Bob to Rindler horizon. So what it means is that we are sending XB to X plus. But of course, if you are sending XB to X plus, then we have one. So on top of this, we are just getting 1 plus A X plus. But of course, 1 plus A X plus on the horizon is equal to 0. Okay, so then omega A, omega B is just equal to 0. All right, so what it means is that if actually Bob is close to the horizon and he sends the signals, then his frequency, well, will actually never reach Alice, or at least, well, it will, the frequency will be 0 when it reaches Alice. If you send some signal from the horizon, you know, it's infinitely redshifted when observed by any other observer in your space time. Okay, so this corresponds to so the Rindler horizon is actually a surface of infinite redshift. So whatever you send from the horizon will only reach, you know, any other observer in the space-time, but now it's infinitely redshifted. The frequency actually goes to 0. Okay, so that's one thing which is interesting. So another thing which is interesting is, well, let's say that you throw something in the Rindler horizon. So let's say my observer is accelerating. And so let's call it frozen flashlight. Okay, so what the picture is, again, this is my Rindler space, and there's my observer here. Okay, let's put it more. Let's put it like that. That's my accelerated observer. And let's say that when the observer is the, well, this is still not nice, although almost nice. When the observer is at time equal to 0, well, of course, this should be, well, whatever. So he throws in the flashlight, okay? So then the flashlight simply goes in the straight line, and it goes towards the Rindler horizon. Yeah?
What it means to have a frozen flashlight?
Okay, I'll just explain it. So that's the title. Yeah, now I'm trying to explain it. Okay? Yes?
Is it also fair to say that the frequency that Bob sees, like Alice chimes a light and Bob sees a frequency. So since omega A over omega B is equal to zero, it means that the ratio is zero with respect to Bob. Is that also right? Because Bob is.
So what I'm saying is that basically on the horizon, the gravity is so strong that you know, whatever you send away from the horizon will never, will be infinite redshifted and will never reach this observer here. On the other hand, I can look at it from the other point of view. I throw something in, right? And then, because now I'm gaining the gravitational energy, if you want, then I'm actually, so that signal here will be infinitely blue-shifted, right? So actually, whatever you send here with a finite frequency will actually arrive here, super frequency.
Okay, but omega A over omega B is equal to zero. Doesn't that imply that omega A is very, very small compared to omega B? So, Bob should receive. So Bob should receive a very small frequency.
No, it's the other way around, right? Right. Omega A is almost zero. So the frequency which reaches Alice is almost zero. All right, so now let's say, you know, this is our accelerated observer, and the observer, you know, at one point, he releases a flashlight. So the flashlight is not accelerated anymore, it just, you know, stands at that given position, right? And so then, however, let's say that the flashlight, I don't know how to draw it. Okay, that's our flashlight, not very nice one. So let's say that the flashlight actually sends signals back to our accelerated observer. Okay, so this is our accelerated observer, accelerated observer trajectory, and this is the trajectory of the flashlight. Flashlight trajectory. Okay, and so we know that in the Rindler space, we are basically still in Minkowski space, right? So we know that the light propagates on a light cone. This is how the light propagates. So the light propagates 45 degrees still, right? So that's the light cone. Looks like that, and that's true everywhere. So everywhere, you know, my light can propagate under 45 degrees. Okay, so if this is the case, then as the light goes actually here, so and I send signals back to the observer, I flash the light there, it has to go under 45 degrees. So it will look like this. Right, so that's the flight, the light I'm sending that's the light the flashlight is sending, right? So that's the light. However, now you notice very interesting thing. So at what time this light is actually observed by that observer? Okay, so let's say everything was released at t equal to zero, and then I have to actually look at, you know, what is the time of the corresponding observer. So that was t equal to one. But then I look at here, and that was at t equal to 10. And then I look at here, and it was at t equal to 100. Okay? And then the last flash of light, which is actually coming, you know, from the horizon, actually reaches my observer at t equal to infinity. This is the line of t equal to infinity. All right. So basically what happens is that although the light travels to the horizon very quickly, maybe, I see that light coming later and later. So basically what it means is that I see as an accelerated observer this thing slowing down as it comes to the horizon, right? And so I see the light coming later and later. And in fact, when the flashlight is exactly crossing the Rindler horizon, well, my time elapsed completely. Okay, so what this means is that so the observer sees the flashlight slowing down as it goes closer and closer to the horizon, as it goes closer to horizon, and in particular, you know, actually, you know, when it really tries to cross the horizon, the flashlight, then an infinite time will elapse for our observer. So it actually, the actual crossing, actually happens at t equal to infinity. Okay, so basically our observer is long time dead before the flashlight actually crosses the horizon. So the observer never sees the flashlight to actually cross the horizon for two reasons. One reason is that it would take him an infinite time to really see it. Second, of course, the flashlight, as it emits the frequency, the frequency is infinitely redshifted, and so I see the flashlight actually flashing darker and darker. Okay, so as it crosses the horizon, it's infinitely dark, and I will see it at t equal to infinity. Okay, are there any questions to this? Isn't that amazing? All right, so there you go. So now what it actually means is that the observer, you know, sees the flashlight slowing down, but he basically, the flashlight will never reach this, so the flashlight freezes on the horizon. So that's why this is a frozen light on the horizon. So light, flashlight freezes there. All right, and so this is very interesting thing. So you can, not only the Rindler horizon is a horizon of infinite redshift, it's the surface of infinite redshift, but basically it's a place where in principle all these objects which I throw in should accumulate, right? They will never cross that that surface in my lifetime, okay? Whatever the T is, they will still be there. Okay, so it's like a big garbage place, right? So where all these objects actually have to stay. At least that's what the observer, the accelerated observer, thinks. Okay? So now, what really happens? So what really happens? With the flashlight? And of course, that depends on who describes that, right? So the guy, well, he sees what he sees, or she sees what she sees. So she knows that, you know, the flashlight will simply, you know, stay on the horizon forever. So now let us look at the same thing from a point of view of the flashlight. So now you are sitting on the flashlight and see, you know, what happens. So the question is, basically, as we are getting closer and closer to the horizon, is something strange happening? Can we actually cross the horizon? Can we go through? So a big question, worth million of dollars, is can we cross the horizon? If sitting on a flashlight, and that's an interesting question, because of course from the point of view of the accelerated observer, this is the space-time. There is nothing beyond the horizon, so there is nothing, you know, where to cross, right? So all the objects get accumulated here, they never cross here. So why there should be something behind the horizon? All right, and so this is also known, this question, to answer this question, is that we want to do a maximal extension of the Rindler space.
When you were explaining the redshift, I understood that it was between Alice and Bob.
Uh-huh.
Now you said that when you're almost in the horizon, there is going to be also a redshift, but it is going to be seen by Bob, but where is...
No. So I'm saying, if you're sending signals with some frequency here, if you have an observer who measures them here and here and here, then they will be infinitely redshifted. Right? So this is my fixed x. So this observer is sitting at, let's say, at x equals 0, right? So however, this is the value here is x is minus 1 over a, right? So I'm sending a signal from position x equal to 1 minus 1 over a to position x equal to 0, right? And the statement is they will be infinitely redshifted, right? That's what we calculated. Yes?
If we're sitting on the flashlight, there is no horizon because we're not accelerated anymore.
Okay, don't tell. We need to discover that, right? That's absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So let's discover that. Okay. So can we cross the horizon? So is there an extension of Rindor space? Of course, we know the answer, and you just said it in the last space. We know that actually this is just part of the Minkowski space, right? And so then we know that, yeah, there is something, there is life behind the horizon, right? But the Rindler observer doesn't see it. So what do we need to do? And so what is the best strategy when you see a horizon and you see a problem is that you just shoot geodesics at that horizon and see what happens. Okay, either the geodesics go through, okay, and then you can extend through, or the geodesics for some reason ends there, and then you cannot extend. And that's the end of the space-time. Okay, the idea is to shoot geodesics. Idea is to shoot geodesics at the problem, so at the horizon. At horizon, and see if they can actually, you know, go through it, or if they end up here. All right. And so geodesics, of course, the simplest geodesics are the null geodesics, the light, you know, how the light travels. So we can choose the simplest one is to use the light-like geodesics. Use null geodesics for simplicity. Okay, these are the simplest geodesics you can have. All right, so, okay, now geodesics have for velocity equal to 0. So we have that 0 is the for velocity, and for velocity is dictated by our Rindler metric element. So it's 1 plus ax squared. So 1 plus ax square t dot square, and then plus x dot square, where we treat now t and x as a function of some parameter lambda, right? So this must be equal to 0. Very good. So now this is just, you know, I can divide by lambda, so I will have something like dt over dx or dx over dt. So we can actually solve this equation super simple. So this is super simple equation. And if you solve it, you find that t is equal to plus minus 1 over a logarithm of 1 plus ax plus a constant. Okay, that's what you find when you're solving the geodesic equation. So of course, what that is nothing else that we are just finding how the straight lines, 45 degree lines, look like in my coordinates t and x, right? Because my coordinates are curve coordinates, they look super simple, like t, small t equals to x in Minkowski coordinates, they are 45 degrees, but in capital T and capital X, there is this bloody logarithm here, okay? So this is how 45 degree lines look like in my coordinates. All right, so now, what this suggests is that, of course, this is my horizon, and now I have a geodesic which goes like this, and the other geodesic which goes like that. Okay, that's how my 45 degree geodesics. And so what the idea is that now you say, well, let's consider this geodesic which actually passes through my horizon, or it actually shoots at my horizon, and let's introduce a new coordinate. So that I introduce a coordinate v and coordinate u, and I see and I say that along this geodesic, v is constant, and just what is changing is coordinate u. Okay, so So introduce new coordinates which characterize my geodesics. So basically, when you integrate this equation, you have plus constant. So what that constant I will call is my new coordinate u or v. Okay, so then we say u is t minus 1 over a logarithm of 1 plus ax, and v is t plus 1 over a logarithm of 1 plus ax. Okay, so then indeed I have introduced the coordinates such that my geodesics, my light-like geodesics, look like u equals to constant or v equals to constant. Okay, that's what my geodesics are. So you see, by studying the geodesics, I know how to introduce new coordinates u and v. All right, so now you may be asking how my metric looks in my geodesics. So I just take that metric, Rindler metric, and do the coordinate transformation on the metric. And what you will find is that the metric now looks like this, is minus e v minus u du dv. Okay. So now looking at this, you see that I still, okay, so now I can choose u to be from minus infinity to infinity and v from minus infinity to infinity. There is no problem with the metric. So now u and v belong from minus infinity to plus infinity. Very good. So that's what I can have here. So now let's look at what happens when the value of u, so I'm looking at this geodesic, which actually shoots at my horizon. And so let's look at what happens when I'm actually approaching that horizon here. What is the value of u there? Anybody knows? So the horizon is, of course, 1 plus ax equals to 0, right? So what is the value of u there?
Infinity.
Huh?
Minus infinity, the logarithm.
Logarithm of 0 is?
Minus infinity.
Right? Uh-huh. And then I have a minus, minus infinity, so it's plus infinity. Okay, very good. So actually, you know, here the value of u is actually plus infinity, and so u goes like from minus infinity all the way to the horizon. And similarly, you would find that v goes from minus infinity on that horizon to plus infinity there. Okay, so this is what happens. So in other words, you know, our horizon still corresponds to a problem, right? So horizon has u equals to plus infinity. And so that's the end of my coordinate, right? So so the horizon is still described by u equal to infinity. I cannot extend beyond infinity. How do I extend beyond infinity? So still cannot, you know, still we cover the same space, same Rindler space with these coordinates. Okay, so still only Rindler space is covered by these coordinates. All right. But then you may look at your geodesic and you are saying my geodesic is described by v equal to constant and u increasing. And then you can look at, you know, how the geodesic equation is actually satisfied. And you will find that it's not the geodesic equation as you would expect, but it's not affine parametrized. This is geodesic where lambda parameter is not a nice parameter. Okay, lambda equal to u is not a nice parameter. So u is not an affine parameter for our geodesic. What it means is that actually the geodesic equation doesn't look like doesn't look nice when you describe it. What you can do is that you can go from u to an affine parameter where the geodesic equation looks nice. So now without a proof, I'll tell you what that is. So now the affine parameter is simply a parametrization of this u. Okay? Parameter for the ingoing geodesic, for the one which goes to the horizon, is simply lambda going is actually minus e to minus u. Okay, so if you go from parameter u for your geodesic to parameter lambda, which is exponential of u, then your geodesic looks nice. All right, but then look at the beauty. So if you have u goes to infinity, lambda in going is actually equal to what? One?
Zero.
So lambda in going on the horizon x plus is actually equal to zero. So I now reparameterize my geodesic. So it goes from, you know, lambda, go, but when I hit the horizon, I actually, my value of the lambda is zero. It's not infinity. It's super simple to extend beyond zero, right? So now I can actually extend that. So similarly, you would find that for lambda outgoing is given by e to v. So that would be the affine parameter for the outgoing geodesic for that one here. So anyway, what this suggests is that I choose new coordinates to be this affine parameterization of the geodesics. So you choose small coordinate u to be this lambda ingoing, which is this e to minus u. And then you choose a new coordinate v, which is the lambda outgoing, which is the e to v. All right. If you do that, then you cross these horizons at finite affine parameter. But now, if you look at the metric, of course, what we are doing is that we are just killing that exponential prefactor there. So now our metric simply becomes minus du dv. Ds square is simply minus du dv. Okay. So in other words, these are like light coordinates which you've seen in your tutorial 2 days ago or whatever. Right? So that's our metric. But now, of course, there is no problem to say that u and v run from minus infinity to infinity. But if they run from minus infinity to infinity, I happily go through the horizon. So now u and v can run from minus infinity to infinity. But what it means is that they cover much more than the original Rindler coordinates. Okay, so this is even nicer if you just go back to the standard Minkowski coordinates, which is the transformation from light coordinates to Cartesian coordinates. So that's what you have done in your tutorial. So you can do u plus v over 2, and you can do u minus v or v minus u over 2. And if you do that, you find that your metric is just the standard Minkowski metric. Of course, it must be minus dt squared dx squared. And now t runs from minus infinity to infinity. X can run from minus infinity to infinity. So basically, what happens is that we have now extended the space-time to the full Minkowski space-time. So this was the original Rindler wedge, right? So this is the Rindler part. And let's call it region 1. And then, this was the Rindler horizon, which was t equal to infinity, or x equal to minus 1 over a. But now we go happily through, and we have new coordinate system, small t and small x. And so because we can go through, we can go here. And so there will be a region 2. And then there will be a region 3 here. And then there will be a region 4, which we now just extended, you know, going here and going there. And then you can also go there. And simply the coordinates t and x cover the whole, you know, 4 regions. And the whole thing is nothing else than the Minkowski space, which we started with, right? So this is the Minkowski. So of course, everything here was just trivial. We knew that it's Minkowski, right? But from the point of view of the observer who was accelerated, he knew only this part. He only knew this part. And the question is how he would know that this is not everything there is. So the idea is you shoot your D6 to your horizon or that horizon, whatever, and then you try to go through that. And of course, you follow the geodesic, and you have to parameterize the geodesic properly. And then you need to show that, you know, even if in one coordinate system the geodesic reaches is only at infinity, maybe I can change the coordinate. So actually, this happens at a finite thing. If I cannot find such a coordinate transformation, of course, then I cannot go through, and that'll be the end of the geodesic. Right? But we could find it's just the exponential of the original coordinate, and then I can go through here and discover the whole spacetime. So this is called a maximal extension. So maximal extension, what we just proved is that maximal extension of Rindler is Minkowski. Okay. Yes?
Is this extension unique?
I think it is. I think so. So you should be viewing that is that like really, I have my manifold, right? I have my manifold, and the manifold is there. But previously, I was stupid that I was describing my manifold just from a coordinate system which covered part of that manifold, right? So I couldn't see what's happening behind that coordinate system. And so, for example, if I want to, you know, now I shoot the geodesic here, and I'm looking, is this really the end of the manifold or not? And you know, by shooting the geodesic, it gives me another coordinate system, and I see that in the new coordinate system, I can actually happily go through. So it's like really discovering what is out there, but you know, starting from one piece of the manifold. So what we are really doing is that we are trying to change coordinates so that we cover the whole manifold.
Why it should be unique?
Well, because the manifold is there, right?
You can have.
Well, you can choose different coordinates and you can describe it differently, but you know, the manifold is a geometric object, right? All right, so that's how you do it. But now what is obvious is that the flashlight was just doing this trajectory here. So it basically was just standing in the Minkowski space. And if you look at the trajectory from the Minkowski point of view, then, you know, we are just standing there waiting some time. But of course, in time t coordinate, you know, this will take a finite time to go from here to there. Let's say t equal to 1, right? And then I keep going there. So I can happily pass through the horizon in my new coordinates in a finite time. So that observer who is actually moving with the flashlight does not see any horizon. And it just, you know, moves in the Minkowski space. Okay, so the flashlight happily goes through the horizon, through, and of course that happens in a finite Minkowski time t, small t. In finite Minkowski t. And that's precisely, you know, the mystery of black holes, right? So they'll have two points of view, right? One point of view of the you are looking at the black hole is that of the observer who is actually outside of the black hole, you know, hovering above the black hole. That observer sees very strange things. That observer sees that the objects, you know, freeze on the horizon. They never cross that horizon. They are infinitely redshifted and so on. On the other hand, if you actually are falling into the black hole, if you are actually falling through the Rindler horizon, nothing strange happens. Well, that's not entirely true. So this is, of course, true for the Minkowski and Rindler space. So now for the black hole, the situation is exactly the same, apart from a teeny tiny difference. So when we went, this is not a good point, when we went from Rindler to Minkowski, we know that, you know, in this region 2, there is nothing else, just a flat space. Similarly, in region 4, as we shall see in a minute, but I will not really show it, is that if you are in black hole case, there will actually be a singularity which will eventually crush you. So that's the only difference. Instead of having flat space here, you will have a singularity there. So let's look at that. Are there any questions to this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Rindler space is also part of a Minkowski space. It is not also flat.
So Rindler space, of course, it is flat. If you calculate the Riemann tensor, right? It is flat, right? It's just written in curve coordinates, right? It's this fake gravity, right? It's this fake gravity. We have non-trivial metric here. There'll be non-trivial Christoffel symbols and so on. But the Riemann tensor, of course, is zero. So the tidal forces are zero, right? So this is the fake gravity. But already fake gravity can have features like horizons. And these features are exactly what is puzzling about black holes. All right, so let's return back to Schwarzschild. So return back to Schwarzschild. And so we know that there was a problem with the shield. So there was a problem in r equal to r plus. So what we are trying to do is that we are trying, so which was our black hole horizon, so r plus, r equal to r plus equals to 2m is black hole horizon. Or very vaguely, we can say something like a boundary of the black hole of the black hole. And what you can show by exactly the same calculation, if you just repeat whatever we done with the frequencies for Alice and Bob, you just calculate what is the redshift of the observer who sends signals from that horizon as r equal to, approaches r plus. And then you find it's infinitely redshifted. So it is a surface of infinite redshift. The calculation goes exactly the same. You will do it in tutorial today, but it's exactly the same thing. You can also show that the objects actually, from the point of view of the observer outside of the black hole, who is not falling inside the black hole but is standing at fixed r, then the objects actually get frozen on the horizon. So again, objects get frozen. Here, when an observer who is outside at fixed r is actually looking for an observer at fixed r, the picture will be exactly the same as we shall see in a minute. Okay, so that's why actually black holes were first called frozen stars. Okay, so because people actually knew that the objects, actually for external observers, get frozen. But of course, then Wheeler coined the term black hole, and everybody got super excited about it. It's certainly much more sexy to call it black hole than a frozen star, right? So from frozen stars, we went to black holes term. And that's the other property, that actually, if you actually send the frequency from the horizon, it's infinitely redshifted, and so you see it as completely dark, right? So that's why this term, that's why that term, both of them are right, but this is the one which is used nowadays. All right? So then the question is, really, can we get similar extension of the Schwarzschild spacetime? So when we are looking at the Schwarzschild metric, of course, we have to specify to r bigger than 2m, then our Schwarzschild metric is well defined, right? And so the question is, can we cross r equal to r plus? Can we cross r equal to 2m in the same way as we did for the Rindler horizon? And so this was the corresponding calculation was done by Kraskal in 1960s, and it was finally when people understood what's happening with Schwarzschild spacetime. So maximal extension. Maximal extension of Schwarzschild was done by Kraskal in 1960. I think it was his PhD thesis, but maybe not. And so basically the idea is precisely the same as we are doing for the Rindler space. So you want to shoot geodesics, null geodesics, at your surface r equal to r plus. Okay, so first you have to study null geodesics in Schwarzschild. You'll find two kinds of geodesics. You choose the one which penetrates the horizon. So now in this coordinate system, still the geodesic ends there on the horizon at finite, at infinite coordinate. So you have to reparametrize your coordinate. And then you come up with the classical coordinates, which are precisely the small coordinates u and v, which we discussed here. All right, so then let me just give the result. So nice, affine parameter coordinates for null geodesics are, so we have u, which is equal to minus e to r star minus t divided by 4m, and v, which is e to r star plus t divided by 4m. And this r star is dr over f, which is r plus 2m logarithm of r over 2m minus 1. So if you look at this thing here, so the r star, precisely comes from the fact when you want to study null geodesics, right? So I have to set ds squared equals to 0, the four velocity is equal to 0, and then I have the metric element f t dot square plus r dot square over f, right? So then that's where this r star comes from. And then I'm just choosing, this is my basically my capital U, and that's my capital V, or what, capital U, capital V, and I'm just doing the exponential. It's precisely the same calculation as we have done for the Rindler space. Exactly the same one. All right, and so now your metric in these coordinates, of course, it's not flat because the Schwarzschild spacetime is not flat, but it looks like this thing here, 32m cubed over r e to minus r over 2m, and then du dv, and then r square d omega square. Okay, so that's the metric, how it looks in the classical coordinates. And you see that if you look at that metric, there is absolutely no problem at r equal to 2m. At r equal to 2m, this is just 1 over e, but everything stays finite and is nice. Okay. Of course, this is not a flat metric. And there is apparently a problem at r equal to 0. Right? But we knew that. There must be a problem at r equal to 0 because there is a true singularity there. All right. So let me now just draw the diagram which I promised you. And that's the classical extension. So basically now we are plotting something like Minkowski space for Schwarzschild. But of course it won't be completely Minkowski. Are there any questions? So of course you can, you know, spend doing this calculation the whole two lectures or whatever. So you can, you know, if you want to see details, they are in every book. But I think, you know, just doing it properly for Rindler and then just saying that this is the same thing is actually, you know, it's true and much nicer. All right. So then, you know, the maximal extension, the classical diagram. Classical diagram for Schwarzschild is the maximal extension . Okay, so we have this and we have that, of course. So now the region, we have four regions. Region 1, region 2, region 3, and region 4. Region 1 is precisely the one which was covered by my Schwarzschild coordinates. It's precisely like the Rindler one. So there is r equal to 2m here. This r equal to 2m surface here. This is r equal to 2m surface there. R equal to 2m. Then r equal to constant for Rindler was this hyperbola, so it's precisely that. So this is, let's say, r equal to, I don't know, 6m. So that's for r bigger. And then we want t equal to constant surfaces, and they are precisely like Rindler, they are straight lines. So for example, this thing here would be, let's say, t equal to 10. And then you would have t equal to 0 here, and then t equal to 100, t equal to 200, and so on. Okay? So this is a t equal to constant surface. And of course, what's happening here is that now I can go through this surface here, through the Schwarzschild horizon. So I can go to smaller r's. And this will be, again, hyperbola. But now the hyperbola will sort of change the character. Okay, so now if I want r equal to m, it will look like this, r equal to m. And finally, you will find that r equal to 0 is another hyperbola. It looks like this. It's r equal to 0. And we know there is a singularity, so people draw this funny, well, like that. But Kelly line, well. Okay. So similar thing happens here. So this will be r equal to m. And then there will be a singularity at r equal to 0. Okay. And so you see that the picture is exactly the same as for Rindler. The only difference is that instead of having Minkowski here, I have some bloody curved space, which actually ends with a true singularity at r equal to 0. And the same is actually here. Okay, so one, region 1 is the original. No, Schwarzschild space. Region 2 is the new space which we discovered by the maximal extension. And because the region 2 is actually hiding behind, this is also r equal to 2m, so it's hiding behind the surfaces r equal to 2m, that's the black hole region. That's where the black hole is and where the singularity is, right? So if you are for r smaller than 2m, then you are in black hole. So this is the black hole region. And this hides singularity at r equal to 0. So now, finally, you have these other two regions, 3 and 4, which are maybe unexpected from the point of view of, you know, a Schwarzschild metric, but they are completely expected from the point of view what we have done before. So we have recovered the full Minkowski space. Oh, it's not here, is it? Oh no, I deleted. But anyway, so we had the full diagram. Oh, it's here. So the full diagram is here. So we had the region 3 and 4. So we had the region 3 and 4 as well here. So now what's happening here, right? So if I have this region 4, it's also region 4 r smaller than 2m. This is r equal to 2m. This is r equal to m. This is r equal to 2m. This is r equal to 0. So this is my region here. What is beautiful about this diagram, which I didn't stress, is that precisely as in Minkowski case, the light travels under 45 degrees. This is the light cone. Okay. The extension is exactly the one. So everywhere here in this point, the light travels under 45 degrees. So now what is obvious is that from this region 4, which is this region here, you know, I can only receive signals when I'm here. So the signals can go here. But of course, from here, I cannot send any signals back to region 4. Right? So the region 4 only sends signals, and it actually sends signals both to region 1 and to region 3. Okay. On the other hand, the region 2 is precisely opposite, right? The region 2 is only absorbing signals from region 1 and from region 3, but it can never send any signals to region 1 or 3. So these are like opposite sides of the coin. This is the heaven and this is the hell, or the other way around. Right? So this is called a black hole region, that's why this is called a white hole region. Okay, so region 4 is the white hole region. And so white hole region can only send signals to our observer regions, but can never receive any signals from there. Yes?
Just how should I understand that there are like two places where R equals zero?
Okay.
Like the same place?
No. They are different places. Okay. So really this is what you get. So if you were in flat space, if you were in Rindler and Minkowski, this would just be infinite past, this would be like infinite future, right? So T goes this way. Right, so you should be thinking maybe about it like that way. It's not precisely, but you know, they simply, this region can exist theoretically if you're describing a black hole.
I don't get why in the inferior part you can emit light and in the other part you can absorb it.
No. So you agree that if I am in this region here, right? If I'm hiding here, I can receive signals from here, from here, from here, from here, from here, right? But I can never send signal from here to there, because that would be space-like, right? So I wouldn't be traveling under 45 degrees. And similarly, I can never send signal here. So this is like a perfect absorber. Perfect absorber. So it only absorbs signals, right? So that's why this is called black hole. It absorbs everything. On the other hand, this one here actually can send signals to regions 1 and 3, but it can never receive anything from there. So this is like a perfect emitter, right? It's like an emitter. Whatever. So this is what is called a black hole, and this is what is called a white hole. Finally, the most funny part, I think, in all this diagram is that we started with this region where our observer lived, right? And of course, if I keep increasing r, so this is r equal to 2m, this is r equal to 6m, r10m, 100m, and whatever, right? So if I keep going away from the black hole, I eventually am in flat space. So this is an asymptotically flat space. If you look at this region here, 3, precisely the same thing happens. This is r equal to 6m, 10m, 100m. So this is also asymptotically flat space. So now we have a new region 3 is a new asymptotically flat space region, which looks like an exact copy of my region 1. So now you discovered another asymptotically flat space-time. Okay. So this is interesting. So now, of course, this puzzled people, and there is a beautiful notion. So let's look at what happens when we actually, you know, try to visualize the geometry on this t equal to constant surface. Okay, so we are making this slice here. We are making a t equal to constant slice. And so as we are going there, of course, what we are getting is that we are getting spatial geometry, right? The spatial geometry will be super curved when I'm close to the horizon, but then it should be getting more and more flat, right? But at the same time, this should be true here. So it should be super curved here, and then it's going to be more and more flat. Okay, so what that geometry actually looks like is quite fun. And you will do it in your tutorial today. More explicitly, let me just tell you the result. So, let us look at let look at t equal to constant slice of our geometry. And to simplify the life, let's just fix angle theta to be something. So let's specify to the equatorial plane theta equal to pi half. And we're setting theta equal to pi half as well. And then what you can do is that you can plot this surface. So of course, what is the induced metric, right? So we are setting t equal to constant. So you take the Schwarzschild metric. So Schwarzschild metric was minus f dt square, but I'm setting t equal to constant, so that term is gone. And then there is a term, which is dr square over f, right? And then there was a term, which was r square d theta square, but theta is pi half, so that is gone. And so then the last term is actually sine square theta is 1, so it's d phi square. So this is the geometry, which is actually lives on that surface, right? Okay, so now this is a two-dimensional geometry, right? So I can change r and I can change phi. So now I may be asking how this geometry looks like when an observer in 3D would look at it. Okay, so now let's embed this. Embed. So to visualize how this geometry looks like, we embed in the space we know, in the 3D space, 3D flat space, Euclidean space, in E3. Okay, x, y, z. Okay, so we embed in this thing. Of course, this is a two-dimensional geometry. So it will sweep some hypersurface in this three-dimensional geometry, right? So this is a two-dimensional thing. So basically, like if I'm trying to plot a sphere, surface of the sphere in a 3D space, right? That will be one embedding. So embedding of the sphere is just I see the sphere in the 3D space. Okay, so then you will do it in your tutorial today. And what you will find is, well, okay, so if I am to the right, if R is quite big, I have to have a flat space. Okay, so this is the flat space. But now, so this is the asymptotically flat space, let's say, of region 1. Of region 1. Okay, so then I keep decreasing R. And as I keep decreasing R, you know, the space starts to be curved. And it starts forming, you know, an interesting neck here. Okay, so this is what starts happening when you start decreasing r. Okay, and so then you reach r equals to 2m. Okay, so now the surface is super curved there. It forms this neck. But then the region 3 starts, right? So then I keep going here, and I have a surface like this. And then I have another asymptotically flat region. And that's the asymptotically flat region 3. Okay. So basically, you know, this geometry looks like a neck connecting two asymptotically flat planes. Okay. So this is a 2D picture, well, 2D surface in 3D, okay? So then we have this neck here, or throat. Or throat, and this neck or throat, it connects to asymptotically flat regions. Does it remind you anything? Have you seen any sci-fi? this is an example of a wormhole. So this looks like a wormhole. A wormhole. In fact, how this is actually called, or the neck or whatever, this is called Einstein-Rosen bridge. Okay, so you are connecting with a bridge to asymptotically flat regions. So this is Einstein Rolls on bridge. And why is it a wormhole? Because, you know, there's a shortcut from asymptotically flat region to another asymptotically flat region. Of course, we would like to have wormholes in our universe, right? If we have wormholes, we can travel from here to very, very distant star. Let's say, you know, these two regions actually are connected somewhere like that. So instead of going like this to the same, you know, we could take a shortcut through the wormhole and we could travel from here to a distant star in no time. So that would be super nice if there are wormholes in the universe. Unfortunately, the problem is that, is this really a wormhole? Can we travel through this? What do you think?
You go to region 2, as opposed to region 3, when you cross.
So what this is displaying is just t equal to constant size. So it's that line in the diagram, right? So are the points on the diagram actually, can I travel from one point to another point? Exactly not, right? Because in order to travel from here to there, I would have to travel faster than light. I would have to travel outside of the light cone. This is a space-like surface. There's no time here, right? So that's why this is not really a wormhole. It's just a geometry, right? I cannot travel from here to there. So cannot, observer cannot travel. Cannot travel through because this is a simply space-like region. So what a true wormhole would be, the true wormhole would be time-like. True wormhole you can actually travel through. So unfortunately, in order to keep this neck or throat open, you need some weird matter. Okay, so typically you can support the wormhole by some matter which does not satisfy the energy condition. So for example, has a negative energy density, right? So you can maybe keep the wormhole open for a short time, but really you cannot travel through it.
So what do you mean by make the wormhole open?
Well, okay, so if I want really this to be a time-like picture, that the observer could travel from here to there, I need to support this neck by some matter, okay? So that matter has unphysical properties. So maybe it's possible to collect matter with unphysical properties for a short period of time, quantum fluctuations.
Is it equivalent to make the wormhole open, is equivalent to extort the space-time to make the wormhole time-like instead of space-like?
Okay, so this wormhole is screwed up. This wormhole is simply space-like and I cannot do that.
Yeah.
Let's imagine a different situation where this is actually time-like. And I could, in principle, travel through. Okay, different situation, not Einstein-Rosen bridge, but something else,
okay.
Right? The true wormhole. So it only looks like wormhole. It's not a wormhole because it's all space-like. Okay, so wormhole, let's stress that, but all space-like. So it is not a wormhole. So in order to have a real wormhole, the time-like wormhole, which I can travel through, you would need a weird matter, and maybe you can make weird matter by quantum fluctuations for a short period of time, but you cannot really sustain it. So at least that's the wisdom now. All right, so we have Einstein-Rosen bridge. What is super interesting is that recently people are crazy about Einstein-Rosen bridge in ADS space. So basically you see that this wormhole has neck of some length. Okay, so there's a length to this neck. And recently, the length of this neck, the wormhole, was conjectured to be related to something which is called holographic complexity. Okay, nobody knows what complexity is, but nevertheless, there's a conjecture the length of this neck is actually related to some property of the quantum field theory living on the boundary of your ADS space. So that will be for ADS black holes. All right, so there's this, you know, similar necks actually correspond to holographic complexity, and people working on this, for example, Rob Myers here. So you can talk to him if you are interested. So basically, how long the neck is more complexity you have. But interestingly, there is another magic formula. So we already know what Einstein-Rosen bridge is this thing here. So of course, there are these two people, Einstein and Rosen. Okay. But there is another thing which you know from quantum theory, which was discussed hopefully in the first part of the course. It's EPR paradox. Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. Okay, that's about the quantum entanglement. Okay, so if I can have two particles which are entangled, so now the conjecture is that you can describe entanglement of two particles by saying these two particles are actually connected by the Einstein-Rosen bridge. They can communicate through the Einstein-Rosen bridge. So in other words, what it means is that Podolsky actually does not matter. And ER is equal to EPR. If you are interested, talk to Rob or at least read Wikipedia. Are there any questions? Yes?
Can we draw a bridge between the white hole and the black hole?
So you would be doing R equal to, it's an interesting thing, no, but R equal to constant is this thing here. What that would be? That's an interesting question. I never tried that. Can you try that? Other questions? Simpler ones? All right, so I still have 5 minutes. So this is all theoretical, right? So we have studied Schwarzschild metric. It's an exact solution of Einstein equations. But of course, it's highly idealized. It has to be precisely spherically symmetric. You have to be precisely in vacuum. And you have to understand that this has been here forever, basically. The metric is static, so nothing is, you know, collapsing or nothing is. OK, so now, of course, there is a long way from Schwarzschild solution to real astrophysical black holes. So really, those black holes which we observe in our universe. So let me just have, I don't know, 3 comments on astrophysical black holes, and let me stop there. So astrophysical black holes. Astro black holes. And so the first remark is that if you are looking at this diagram here, so this spacetime, the classical extension spacetime, has been here forever. However, what is assumed about astrophysical black holes is that they were formed by a gravitational collapse of a star. Okay, so that what it means is that you have a star which has some surface of radius something, I don't know, 100 m. That's the radius of the star you start with, and then the star starts collapsing. So whatever is actually hiding behind, you know, below r equal to 100 m is the star, right? There is no white hole. There is no region 3. So this is the surface of the star, and it simply goes, it's getting smaller and smaller, it goes to r equal to 2m, and then it crashes in the singularity. So everything what is actually written here is hiding behind the surface of the star. So you don't see this part of the diagram, you only see that part of the diagram. So you only see the Schwarzschild part of the diagram. And then there's a final singularity. Okay, so astro black holes, so regions, what they were, 3 and 4 are hidden inside star, as it collapses to form a black hole, and so they are unphysical. That's the first remark. So you have this beautiful classical extension, but maybe in our universe the white hole really does not exist. There are speculations that it might, and the other asymptotic region maybe does not exist.
But doesn't R get bigger on the other side, region 3?
Yeah, but
what do you mean by behind?
No, but this region is different from that region. So now I live in a universe, so I have to specify my observer lives in a universe, let's say in this region, right? So then he will never know about that region there, right? So that region is simply hiding. Okay, so that's the first remark. Second remark is that black holes actually rotate. So Schwarzschild metric is not really the right metric to describe them. So instead, you need something which describes a rotating black hole. There is such solution, and it took much longer for people to discover it. So whereas Schwarzschild came with the solution 1 month after Einstein published his equation, this took 50 years. Okay, so there is a corresponding Kerr solution, and this was in 1963. So this is how long people had to wait for finding a solution for a rotating black hole. What is super nice about this black hole is that it's described only by two parameters. It's described by the mass and the angular momentum. So mass and the angular momentum, which is m times a. A is sometimes called rotation parameter. And there is nothing else. So just the two parameters, m and j, they describe all the properties of the of this black hole. So only two parameters. Only two parameters. Well, from an astrophysics point of view, this is crazy, right? Your star is a star, which is a red giant star, and is described by 1,000 parameters, right? You need 1,000 parameters to describe the actual star. You need its temperature, you need, I don't know, its size, you need wobbling of the surface, you need all these things. Black hole is simply described by only two parameters, the angular momentum and the mass. All, you know, the higher poles, multipoles, quadrupoles, and whatever, are simply expressible in terms of these two parameters. Okay, so now you may be saying, well, this is just one example of the black hole, right? What if there are other black holes? But actually, there are not. This is the only black hole there is. So there is a uniqueness theorem. Uniqueness. And that says that basically Kerr is the only one, is the only black hole. In vacuum. Okay? So Kerr is the only one. So if you think about, you know, some strange multiples things and whatever, all these things which were present originally in the star have to radiate away to settle down to a nice black hole, which is just described by two parameters. Okay, the fact that all the multiples, everything gets radiated away, is described by Wheeler by a nice theorem, is that the black hole actually lost all its hair. Right? All the hair is gone. So this is called no hair theorem. Okay? No hair theorem. There is nothing else than A and then M and J. Okay? But of course, the real life is a little bit more complicated. So this would be the rotating black hole in idealized world. But of course, the black holes are not exactly in vacuum. The black holes actually are surrounded by the corresponding plasma in the universe. And then this plasma typically actually tries to suck into the black hole in form of the accretion disk. So then the surrounding plasma, typically accretes to black hole. And then what you really observe is that this is your black hole, which is rotating. The black hole rotates. But then you have lots of matter, which sort of, you know, accumulates around the black hole. And so you have the matter which sort of goes around like this, and goes around like that, and goes around like that. So this is actually the accretion. So it basically, the matter moves on the circular trajectories, or almost circular trajectories around the black hole. And this is called accretion disk. All right. And so what is really funny, and that this accretion disk is basically some thing like the friction is very important. So if you have matter which is accreting, so of course these particles or these things, they move at different velocities. So there's a friction. If there is a friction, there is an energy production. Okay, that's why the accretion disk is superluminous. So there's lots of energy actually produced in here. So this actually produces energy, produces lots of energy. And as it produces the energy, of course, you know, the matter loses its angular momentum and it loses energy and it falls gradually to the black hole. So you start here and then you revolve many times around and then you actually end up, you know, very, very close to the black hole. But we discussed yesterday that we cannot go arbitrarily close to the black hole. I maybe haven't stressed that, but at r equal to 6m, this is the last circular orbit you can have. Okay, so there is a there is an orbit here, which is called ISCO, which is like innermost stable circular orbit, last circular orbit. You cannot orbit closer than that. For Schwarzschild, this is 6m. 6m for Schwarzschild. For rotating black hole, it can be different depending on whether you co-rotate with the black hole or whether you counter-rotate with the black hole. But anyway, so once you reach 6m, there are no more circular orbits. So I actually have to fall inside the black hole. So what this ISCO really is the inner horizon of the accretion disk. So that's where the accretion disk ends, right? So then the matter simply falls inside the black hole. It doesn't radiate anymore. So I will see this as a dark inside. And so there will be accretion disk, which is superluminous. And then I will see a dark spot inside. This is what Event Horizon Telescope saw. Okay, so they could really see this inner edge. So this is the edge of accretion disk of the disk, and this is what was also observed by Event Horizon Telescope. So if you want to know all the details, talk to Avery Broderick, who is here, was one of the key figures in this observation. Are there any questions? Isn't this beautiful? Yes?
So the black spot in the picture wasn't the event horizon, it was the surface of, I don't know.
So what happens, right? So I have a horizon of the black hole. That's r equal to 2m, right? This is r equal to 2m. But then, actually, the spot which is dark is much bigger. It's the one where actually there is no radiation of matter. That goes to r equal to 6m. So above r equal to 6m for non-rotating black hole, I can have an accretion disk. As the matter accretes and slowly goes in, spirals in, it produces lots of energy, and this radiates away. So I see this thing here as extremely bright. But of course, here there is nothing to produce light or nothing to produce energy. So this is completely dark. So what you are seeing dark is actually below ISCO. It's not the horizon of the black hole, it's below the ISCO thing. Another thing which you can see is the jet, which come from the north and south pole. Okay, again, there is a very big theoretical question how these jets actually are produced. So people still don't really understand how the energy is transferred from the accretion disk to these jets here.
In experiment, they saw the jets?
In experiment, you mean in numerics or?
In this
simulation. Well, the jets are seen like, for supermassive black holes, you see the jets of energy, right? So I don't know if that in that picture. But you know, jets you see, there's no problem to see them. The problem is to predict them theoretically and to actually see them in simulations, in numerical simulations. It was the case that a couple of years ago that it's still every time people almost saw, you know, formation of jets, the code would break down. I don't know if this is the case any longer. Maybe people can now see jets. But okay, there was one more question, or was it answered? Okay, let me stop here. Sorry for going over time.